Campus FM jippreżenta lecture organizzata mill-Istitut Agostinjan bit-titlu St. Augustine the Algerian is meant as a provocation and not as a description of a past historical reality. Il-kellema hija Professor Carla Polman.
Thank you very much for this kind invitation. It's a great pleasure for me to be here and enjoy your warm hospitality. And it's great to see so many of you back. I hope you can all understand me also at the back. Good. The title of this lecture, Saint Augustine the Algerian, is meant as a provocation and not as a description of a past historical reality. It is a statement about the possible influence and relevance of a historical figure in a later time, in this case, the present. The United Nations declared 2001 to be the year of the dialogue of the civilizations. Accordingly, the President of Algeria, His Excellency Abdelaziz Bouteflika, had the idea of organizing in his country a conference on Saint Augustine, le philosophe algérien. This enterprise had the twofold intention of, in the first place, making Algeria aware of its pre-Islamic past and reclaim it for it. At present, pre-Islamic Algerian history is not taught in Algerian schools and universities. And secondly, of reconciling Algeria with its pre-Islamic past and opening it up for a dialogue with the Western civilizations in general, using Augustine as an ideal bridge, as he came from Africa and influenced Western thought. It was hoped that both aims would help the young nation of Algeria on its way to establishing an identity for itself, an identity which could not be based on economic and financial facts alone, nor on a reductive ideology. Hence, this conference gathered around 40 internationally recognized experts on Augustine from 16 countries to present up-to-date scholarship at what was to be a highly political event, with national and international media attention and strict security measures. The hosts of this event were the Haut Conseil Islamique of the Algerian government and the Swiss Foreign Office. The motto of the conference in Algeria was taken from a 4th century mosaic from Tipaza in North Africa, which, that's too much. Thank you. I'm not that good, sort of. a mosaic only found in 1968, and you have this mosaic on your little booklets. You all have been given little booklets, which were produced actually in connection with this conference by the Swiss as a gesture of, if you like, Augustine as a figure of integration. And it contains sayings of Augustine in Latin, English, and Arabic. And they are all sayings which are sufficiently neutral to be appealing to all sorts of faiths. Yeah, so one avoided Christological and Trinitarian things. But Augustine's thought is so rich that it was no problem for us to find other sayings. Now, this mosaic was the motto, and I read out to you the Latin, In Deo pax et concordia sit convivio nostro. That means, may our festive gathering have peace and harmony in God. And it is a mosaic which comes from the time of Augustine. The conference itself took place in April 2001 in Algiers and in Annaba. And of course, after the events of September 11 of that very same year, even greater significance has come to be attached to its agenda. Needless to say, due to the unstable political situation in present-day Algeria, it was uncertain up to the end whether the conference would take place or not. Several invited speakers declined the invitation because they were frightened, or chickened out shortly beforehand. When I boarded the plane Paris-Algiers, I was given the Algerian version of the French newspaper La Tribune. The front page was ominously dominated by two articles. In the upper half, a headline announced that the night before, five people had been brutally massacred in the just-mentioned Tipaza, a place roughly 70 kilometers southwest of Algiers. Originally, it had been planned to go and have a look at the spectacular archaeological sites there, and I have one slide just to give you an impression. My slide controller, thank you very much. This is the Basilica of Saint Salsa in Tipaza. Now, understandably, this excursion was cancelled. The lower half of the front paper of this newspaper was occupied by an article about the imminent colloquium on Saint-Augustin. The structure of this newspaper's front page gives you the situation of the country in a nutshell. One may legitimately ask oneself how it happens that the president of an Islamic country, when intending to extend gestures of cultural reconciliation towards the Western world, comes to think of a Christian saint. Could not other topics have been far more obvious? For example, postmodernism and multiculturalism in the 21st century, or the interaction of ethics and faith in cultures of the industrialized nations and its impact on developing countries. The explanation of this perplexing situation is quite simple. President Bouteflika had been a student at the University of Algiers in the 50s. At that time, Algeria was still French, the university therefore dominated by the French. Significantly, Mr. Bouteflika studied with Professor André Mondouze, an internationally renowned expert on Augustine. No academic teacher is ever in control of what fruit his or her teaching may bring forth. A perhaps surprising outcome for Professor Mondouze, now in his late 80s, if he's still alive, with 89 or something, 80, was that he came at that time to be one of the key organizers and honest guests of this conference. He's widely adored in Algeria as he fought for Algeria's independence in the 50s and 60s, and had to go to prison for that in France. Due to the highly political nature of the event, it is not surprising that different expectations and reactions were linked with it, reflecting a whole spectrum of ideological and intellectual attitudes. The organizers, and accordingly the invited speakers, aimed at a strictly historical analysis and discussion of Augustine's thought, illuminating its broad spectrum, depth, and originality in a world of change. A small but extreme Catholic wing, represented by a group of Italian intellectuals, expected the conference to form part of an initiative to re-Christianize the Islamic world, and was bitterly disappointed not even to have the chance of going to Mass during their stay in Algiers. We then celebrated a Mass in Annaba. But they didn't wait that long, and some left before the conference had finished. A third group consisted of some Algerian intellectuals who accused Augustine of belonging to the urban Roman class of suppressors, who eliminated the rural vernacular church of the Donatists, a heretical group who held the view that their Christian community, based in North Africa alone, was the only true church due to their steadfastness in the times of persecution. Augustine had promoted the integration of the Donatist church into the wider Catholic church, sometimes against the will of those involved. Some hold that this reluctant acceptance of the Roman Catholic faith made it easier for the North African population to accept Islam when the Arabs conquered them about 200 years later. It did not become clear whether this was to be seen as something positive or negative by those at our conference who saw Augustine as a suppressor of vernacular faith. Regarding this question, much heat was generated and little light. Such diverse and controversial views have been characteristic of the reception of Augustine throughout history. Notably, for instance, Catholics and Protestants have both claimed Augustine to be one of them, while Luther, an Augustinian monk who was excommunicated, I think now there is talk of getting him back again, that's right, and Calvin espoused the later Augustinian views on grace and predestination, some Catholic writers gravitated towards the younger Augustine, who, as a recent convert, still tried to adapt Neoplatonic thinking to Christian concepts of free will and salvation through works and contemplation. Despite the fact that some Renaissance writers recognized the importance of discerning the changes in Augustine's position during his lifetime, and that means 44 years of writing activity as a Christian, and some, like Petrarch, had already struggled to reconcile Augustinian tensions, most writers appropriated the Augustine that suited them best. And some still do, all claiming Augustine to be theirs. Indeed, it is in no way surprising that some time ago the Tunisian Minister of Culture called Augustine one of their great thinkers in a lecture delivered in London. And now I just give you a few information. Some of that will already be very well known to you, but I will link it with a few slides. Augustine, as the name Augustinus, means little Augustus, little emperor, was born 354 in Tagaste in North Africa in a Roman province called Africa Proconsularis. Partly overlapping with the area that is Algeria today. You see here a slide of the landscape. There are no ruins extant of ancient Tagaste as the new city was built on top of the old. And you see this is northern Africa, and of course it's relatively close to the coast. And some people ask me whether I had actually taken this in Switzerland. because when we think of Africa, we normally have different connotations. Augustine was educated in grammar and rhetoric in Madauros. Next slide, please. And there we have a very beautiful ancient ruins. Madauros is also in Africa Consularis, situated in what is today Algeria. Then he continued his education in Carthage, the capital of Africa Consularis. Very mighty ruins, but that is today situated in Tunisia, which therefore can also claim the fame of being in some way the home of Augustine. After traveling to Rome, Milan, where he became a professor of rhetoric, and other places, he became first priest and then bishop of Hippo Regius, today Annaba, French born, where both Lucien and Pierre have also served as priests, in a way, the successors of Augustine. And this is also situated in Africa Proconsularis, today Algeria. And I give you, this is directly on the coast, and I show you here some slides, another one as well, from the surrounding landscape. And we come later to the town itself. Now just very briefly, for our geographical reassurance, I show you two maps, if you could continue. Presumably many of you will know this, but this is the Roman Empire around 400. Yeah, the Romans dominated more or less the entire Mediterranean, And we are talking about Africa Proconsularis here, so Malta is not very far away, of course. It is a very exciting period. So this is a historical atlas, yeah, with the Roman provinces. And if you go to the next page of that atlas, you will find here a different color, and it will say Kingdom of the Vandals. Yeah, and maybe some of you know that Augustine was literally dying inside Hippo when the Vandals were starting to storm Hippo. And after he died, indeed, they took Hippo. And up to this very day, it's a miracle that his library could be saved, because they, of course, destroyed a lot of things. And here you see the sharp separation of the eastern part of the empire and the western. That's the Latin-speaking part. That's the part we are interested in. Sorry, I hope you can see this. Could you give me the next slide? Just very briefly, because it's a bit complicated. Also, this is a sketch of northern Africa with a lot of archaeological sites. And in some of them, archaeological excavations can be done. In Algeria, I understand it is very difficult or impossible because of the political situation, which is, of course, a great shame. But you see that here is Carthage at the sea, and then Hippo Regius also at the sea, and various other cities Augustine had to do with, and they are all safely situated in Algeria. So in that sense, if you want to modernize, he is more an Algerian than a Tunisian. Augustine was in office as bishop for over 30 years and died in Hippo in 430. Hence, as you all know, he is often referred to as Augustine of Hippo, in order to distinguish him, for instance, from the much later Augustine of Canterbury. As far as Augustine's social origin is concerned, he was not a member of the aristocratic elite. Owing to the ambition of his parents, which is already reflected in his name, Augustinus, little Augustus, he was given an education, strictly speaking, above his social status, as they were impoverished gentlefolk of slender means. It was the dream of his mother that he should become a senior Roman civil servant, ideally culminating in becoming provincial governor, which meant, among other things, marrying a woman with the appropriate family background. His Christian mother was also very keen that he should become Christian. Augustine was not born a Christian, and many people claim that his theology has the intensity it has because he underwent conversion at a much later stage, which exposes you in a different way to matters of faith. However, Augustine proved to be a bit of a disappointment. He never rose in the civil service, and even becoming a Christian took him a long time. The dramatic story of his gradual conversion forms the center of his quasi-autobiographic Confessions. We do not know a specific date for his conversion. Even if, in a television episode of Inspector Morse, I don't know whether here in Malta you know about this, this is a very famous sleuth, a small congregation told Morse that they had celebrated the feast of the conversion of Saint Augustine. And I got slightly nervous because I had never heard of this feast. It took Morse a while to find out that this feast does not exist and was a sham to stage a murder. It is tempting to reflect that if Augustine had followed the career path dreamed of by his parents, his name would now be one among many others buried in the prosopography of the later Roman Empire. And his claim to fame would perhaps consist in having built a new aqueduct or the like. At Hippo Regius, his bishopcy, we have a very unusual mosaic from the early 3rd century, when Roman Africa was at its economic peak. This mosaic was split in half by the foundations of the later building on the site. So this is an overview of what the mosaic looks today as a whole, and now we move to the next slide. This part of the mosaic contains a fishing scene with men in boats drawing on nets. At the right end, it represented a coastline, a cape with a distinctive profile, crowned with trees. The next slide shows the other fragment, that's the more interesting one. On the other fragment, the buildings along the shore are shown, with the sea in front breaking upon rocks, with a triton swimming among them. The buildings themselves are highly distinctive, though there are many crudities in the execution. At the top is a wooden bridge, and I'm assured by my archaeological colleagues that bridges are very rare in mosaics, presumably crossing a river. In front, from the left, the buildings include what could well be a basilica with a colonnaded facade and three aisles, a long two-storied building which might be a market, then probably a triumphal arch surmounted by a sculptural group with a figure driving a chariot with four horses. More colonnaded buildings, and finally on the right, one with an arcade in front of several small domed constructions, surely a set of baths which stick out into the sea. As you may know, the Romans had a great bathing culture, and once a Germanic leader came to the Emperor Hadrian and asked him why he took a bath every day. And Hadrian said, "Yeah, I'm very sorry, but I'm very busy, so I can't take two." So baths are very, very Roman. The careful delineation of these buildings and the prominent part which they play on the mosaic distinguish this scene completely from any normal fantasy architecture. The mosaicist is evidently trying, within the limits of his conventions, to portray real buildings. It is generally accepted that this mosaic represented the town of Hippo itself, which is unique on African mosaics and an exceptional expression of civic pride. Hearing that Augustine was born in North Africa in a politically correct age, one is asked occasionally, also by academics, the question, was Augustine black? I have not yet been asked whether Augustine was a woman, but maybe this will come. One possibility to try and answer this question is to look at his ancestry. We know that his mother was called Monica. I discussed this with Lucia. Her name is derived from a local Numidian deity, the goddess Mon. It is possible that Monica was of Numidian or Berber descent. Augustine's father was called Patricius. We cannot tell whether he was a Romanized native of some sort or a member of a Roman family that came to Africa at some point. Moreover, the history of the settlement of North Africa is complicated. Native Berbers seem to have occupied the country since prehistoric times. Their origins and racial affinities are not definitely known. The later Phoenicians came from what is today the Near East around the 12th century before Christ. Later still came the Romans. And in this mix, a genetic mix, if you like, Augustine may have been of Punic or Berber descent and could in theory have looked anything from blonde and freckled. We saw blonde and freckled Berbers in Algeria, via the Mediterranean to the Negroid type. Interestingly, ancient sources do not tell us, as in generally they relatively seldom comment on a person's color of skin. Another way of deciding the question could be to have a look at ancient likenesses of Augustine. And that's the next picture. I'm sure many of you know this. This is the so-called Lateran fresco in Rome, commonly dated into the middle of the 6th century, so roughly 100 years after Augustine's death, and it is considered to be the oldest extant depiction of Augustine. It shows a man slightly beyond his best years, the hairline over the forehead clearly receding, with quite pronounced facial wrinkles, dressed in a long white tunic with long sleeves, decorated with a purple stripe that marks the person's dignity, in this case sacerdotal or episcopalian dignity, analogous to a senator's purple stripe. And it is not very likely that this is the authentic dress of Augustine, because we know from sources that he used to dress in a very modest fashion. The figure is seated on a so-called curule chair, a cella curulis, originally used by high magistrates. The painter clearly had difficulties with perspective. Augustine's left hand holds a book roll, a so-called volumen, volume, yeah, volumen means book roll, which hints at his education and his intellectual qualities, and can also be taken as symbolizing his written work. But, strictly speaking, this is an anachronism, as Christians used the modern parchment codex, the book, and not the traditional pagan papyrus book roll for publication, as the Christians were very advanced when it came to disseminating their writings. Augustine's right hand points in a particular gesture at such an open book, a codex, most likely the Bible or another book, presumably of Christian content, thereby positioning this portrait intellectually between antiquity, i.e. the book roll, and the Middle Ages, i.e. the codex, the book. And that's, of course, exactly what we also said yesterday. Augustine is a liminal figure, yeah, a hinge between antiquity and the Middle Ages. There is a description under this fresco in a so-called elegiac couplet, that's two lines, in correct classical meter. And I read it out to you in Latin and then give you a translation. It's a very famous couplet. Diversi diversa patres, sed hic omnia dixit, Roman eloquio, mystica sensa tonans. Various fathers spoke about various themes, but this one said it all, proclaiming forcefully like thunder, in Roman eloquence, the mysteries of the scriptures. Now, the gesture of the right hand on this portrait is familiar to those studying classical rhetoric. Presumably, this was a gesture of drawing attention to an important point. And it was something which both before and at the time of Augustine was also used by pagans when they were talking. And I show you two artifacts. Can you please give me the next picture? Here you see on the right a high Roman magistrate performing exactly the same gesture. And another one, please. I hope you can see this, especially in the bottom line. You see these guys really run wild. Yeah? They are really having very passionate arguments at each other. And these are both pagan examples that this gesture was used at the time of Augustine. But also we have documents that the Christians adopted this gesture because they were brought up in the same intellectual culture. So I give you the next one. Is now, that's a very beautiful example, I find. This is God speaking to Abraham. And you know that, of course, especially the Old Testament doesn't want that we have an image of God. So I think this is artistically a very convincing way of still indicating this is God speaking to Abraham in an abstract but nevertheless clear way. Another one. Here you have Christ himself performing the same gesture and also having a book as the Christian, if you like, symbol of learning in his other hand. And finally, this is from the early 5th century, the personification of the church herself. And she looks a bit like a nun. Also that's a mosaic from 422. Also this is very much the lifetime of Augustine, also performing this gesture and holding a codex. With this iconographic evidence, it is clear that Augustine on the fresco is not reading but speaking, or rather teaching in a formal and authoritative way, interpreting the Bible as he indeed did in the spoken and written word for the major part of his life. As many of you will know, this hand gesture became in medieval depictions the gesture of benediction. according to correct rhetorical rule, only to be performed with the right hand. And all the artifacts I have shown you indeed only perform it with the right hand. The Lateran fresco follows in many ways the conventional depiction of an educated, pagan, intellectual as an emblematic type, which could be adapted for Christian purposes. This can also explain the anachronistic book roll, whose conservative, stereotyped usage is especially transparent in a miniature. This is now the next. This is from the Codex Virgilius Romanus, as also a book from the from 500 AD, but this is a pagan text, also the poems of the pagan poet Virgil. And this is actually the poet Virgil, and you see he looks in a way relatively similar in way of dress. He also wears the white tunic and holds a book roll in his hands. This portrait was originally depicted on a papyrus roll, and of course it's a papyrus roll, and Virgil holds such a papyrus roll in his hand, symbolizing his own poetry. Then later, this image was copied into a codex, but then, if you like, the papyrus roll was not changed into a codex, but in an old-fashioned way, or anachronistic way, this symbol of learning was kept. And there is a similar depiction of Virgil from a beautiful African mosaic from the 3rd century, also from Africa. That's very famous. And he also wears a relatively similar dress of the educated aristocratic Roman, and in his hand he holds the book roll, and the letters even describe the beginning of one of his famous Latin poems, and the ladies next to him are inspiring muses. But scholars have noted that several things are unusual about the Lateran fresco, and that's the next slide, so we just return. First, the depiction of the figure is not 100% frontal as the others, but from a three-quarters angle, with the figure leaning to the side, giving it a less static impression. The facial traits are marked with scrutinizing eyes, wrinkles, a strong nose, pronounced mouth, the chin separated from the mouth by a dimple, and the shadow of the beginning of a beard due to not shaving every day. Romanticizing French scholars in particular have suggested that this was the copy of a realistic portrait of Saint Augustine, which somehow must have made its way to Italy. However, these features do not seem to be so unique or individual. For instance, and can I please have the next picture? I'm now talking about this face here at the bottom. This is a 4th century African mosaic showing a male face with quite similar characteristics. Also the wrinkles, not that much hair, pronounced eyes and nose and chin. But this time, this is a Cylon or a satyr, i.e. a figure from mythology. So I'm afraid we have to content ourselves with a not proven verdict. Leaving the seemingly individual traits aside, the Lateran portrait clearly represents a type, meaning to convey the message of Augustine's importance as the teacher of Christianity. That we can say for sure. Now some remarks about Augustine and his church in Hippo. As already mentioned, Hippo was a wealthy trading town, especially in the 2nd and 3rd century. And you've already seen the mosaic that documents. This is the way to the Forum, and of course both Lucien and Pierre will know all this. On the hill you see the new basilica of Hippo on the so-called Mameluke. This is the ancient Forum, and there are also at least 2 Catholic churches, and the two were situated in the so-called Christian Quarter, and there's also a slide. This is now a view from the hill down onto the site, that you see how it looks, what it looks like. This site was only excavated in the 1920s and is in desperate need of professional conservation. And as I understand, even the conference, which had raised lots of hopes that a lot would now happening there, has not really kept what it promised. There is another. There you can also see again from the other side the Christian quarter with a view also of the new cathedral. The ancient ruins are outside the modern city, which is of course in a way good luck, because then we can excavate them and the new town is somewhere else. That you can see that clearly on the next. You see the ancient ruins are at the front and the new town is further down. And historically, this can be explained because the old town was deserted in the early Middle Ages because the sea had receded. And people, of course, want to live as close to the sea as possible for reasons of transportation. Presumably the most moving moment for all Augustinian scholars during the whole conference was the chance to see and enter, as it were, the very church in which Augustine was active for over 30 years. This is, I'm afraid, taken from a book, but it is the best photograph I could get. And I have heard already, you know, this is called either the Basilica of Peace or sometimes simply the Major Basilica. It was built in various stages during the 4th century and was over a place that was once a pagan sanctuary of Saturn, following the familiar pattern of keeping well-known locations of worship. The dimensions of the basilica are still recognizable, measuring 37 times 18 meters, one of the larger churches, but not the largest in North Africa. Augustine himself documents that the longitude of the church was twice its width, a popular proportion for churches at his time. And at that time, people, when they went to Mass, had to stand. Actually, only the bishop had the right to sit down. And therefore, you have very different figures, how many people at one time could have had access and listened to Augustine. And I have figures that vary between 300 and 2,000. So presumably anything between those two is true. Then the next slide, please. The baptisterium, the baptistry, measuring 4 times 4 meters, is particularly well preserved. And the next slide gives you now a reconstruction of the basilica at the left, and then in roughly the middle, the baptisterium, and to the right, side houses which would host the monastic community. And then please the next slide. This is a slide which is very instructive. You recognize slightly in the middle a path, and to the left you see the baptisterium of Augustine's church, so that church would go to the left. And then if you go further down that path, on the right upper corner, you see something that looks like a different church. And one has identified, at least supposedly, this church with the rival Christian Donatists. And this gives you, in a way, a visual impression why Augustine complains that the Donatist church over the road held uproarious feasts with loud singing that could be heard in the Catholic church and disturbed their services. And now a few remarks about the church as community. As I have already mentioned, the settling history of North Africa is very complicated, and accordingly the issue of language is also complicated. The Punic language, developed from Phoenician, is closely related to Hebrew. It is most likely, but very difficult to prove, that both Libyan or Berber and Punic or Phoenician coexisted with Latin in Roman North Africa as rival languages, spoken only by certain classes or groups of society. As for Augustine, one of our most important witnesses about African vernacular, he spoke only Latin, his mother tongue, and found Greek a difficult language when he was taught it at school. He knew a few words of what he calls Punic, but complained that there were not enough translators from Latin to Punic who could spread the gospel in the countryside. He also knew that there were nomads further south beyond the civilized world with whom he had no contact and about whose language he did not know anything at all. The language and culture issue remains a problem in Algeria up to the present day, in what is called the Berber question. This is a sensitive political issue, I think, still. Perhaps about 20-30% of the Algerian population would call themselves Berber. At the moment, Berber culture and language are not officially recognized by the Arab Islamic regime. Naturally, in Augustine's day, pagan traditions and beliefs were still to the fore. In one of his recently found sermons, he has to admit that it was impossible for him to convert a well-trained pagan intellectual to Christianity by way of argumentation. And yesterday you got a certain flavor of that. He tried very hard. Moreover, pieces of art surrounding Augustine partly reflected different traditions. I take as an example the Mask of Ocean or Neptune. As I think this is one of the most beautiful mosaics in the world, and I just thought this has to be in this lecture. Although the Mask of Ocean is not an African invention, nor confined to Africa even in mosaics, the exceptional frequency with which it occurs in Africa and the remarkable care accorded to its delineation in some of the mosaics have suggested that it represented some element which was strong in the African, specifically the Punic, religious conscience. We have here a majestic bearded mask from the baths at Temetra in Tunisia, which is dated into the early 3rd century. It's quite a large mosaic, measuring 1.7 times 1.2 meters, so it's larger than life. The motifs of the mask are conventionally treated. Lobster claws and coral branches on his forehead, streaks of gray and green in his hair and beard, indicating seaweed, with fish and dolphins entangled in them. Beneath Ocean's bushy and puckered eyebrows, his severe yet pathetic gaze was often, as often in such depictions, turned upward and toward the left. Can you just show the next one? Just that you can see this even more, how carefully these eyes, I mean, he almost used mascara to make them more expressive. These masks appear in an indisputably secular context, and it has been suggested that their meaning goes beyond the purely aesthetic. They could have had a magical or apotropaic, i.e. protective, force against superhuman hostile beings, a force which is principally resident in the enormous eyes with their fixed stare. Just to give you another example, I have given you one. This is far less elaborate, but again, the strong domination of the eyes is clear. The interesting thing is that we have some mosaics where the eyes or even the whole face have been deliberately destroyed, presumably by Christians who considered the power residing in these eyes as hostile and demonic. In our case, please to the next, yeah. Where the mask is associated with realistically portrayed boats. You can't see the boats on this or only at the very top, but there are some boats on the mosaic as well. There is probably an idea that in this way, real boats, presumably those belonging to the owner of the house and the mosaic, are placed under the protection of ocean on their journey. Granted portraits like this, it can readily be seen why Augustine argues against belief in the religious or magical powers of images, statues, and natural entities like the sea. he chooses Neptune or ocean as an example to criticize these false beliefs. I quote, "For me, after all, neither any statue at all, nor the entire sea, is God." And this was actually the last slide, so if you like, you can switch on the light or you can keep it like this. Augustine, like many ecclesiastical writers before him, was strictly against attributing any kind of supernatural power or magic to objects, like amulets or images. His opposition to purely decorative iconography as an end in itself may account for the simplicity of his own Basilica of Peace, which appears in the examination of the ruins. Accordingly, Augustine advises his congregation to find beauty not in decorative marble and splendid embellishment, but rather in the example of saints and in the glory of God. All this, of course, was most appealing to Reformation Protestants and their traditions. Now, a few general remarks about Augustine and his work. And, of course, you have studied something about this, so I hope you recognize some of the things I'm going to mention. Despite the fact that Augustine as a bishop had already a full-time job, he has left us an enormous literary output. Only a small part of his writings is lost. Most notably, all the writings are lost he wrote before he converted to Christianity, and it is assumed that he himself made sure that nothing would survive from that period. Now, there is, as you may know, now the entire work of Augustine available electronically on databases, and this database counts over 5 million words of his extant oeuvre, the largest to survive from any ancient author. The last two decades of the 20th century were exciting for Augustinian scholarship because of the discovery of some 30 letters and 30 sermons previously unknown, which furthered our understanding of Augustine's daily life. Despite the great diversity of Augustine's work, I would like to suggest 5 main common strands that can be identified in his thought. The first reflects the fact that originally Augustine was a professionally trained orator and teacher of rhetoric, and he was later very ashamed of that and said, "I will never do this again." But of course, how you have been trained in a way always influences your later activities. He was used to making an argument persuasive, the main task of rhetoric, and employed any means to serve this end, not least discourse at the emotional level, the most effective means of manipulating people. A lot of his work is written against bitter intellectual opponents, where arguments can become polemical and extreme. Arguments of this kind must be viewed with caution. Taken out of context, they are open to false interpretation and cannot be claimed to be Augustinian dogma, as they are strongly context-related. For instance, at one and the same time, in his later years, he elaborated his sometimes sinister views about predestination, while also writing a treatise on Christian preaching, the fourth book of De Doctrina Christiana, in which he is quite optimistic about human possibilities. Augustine's power of language and expression have fascinated people through the centuries. His already mentioned Confessions may be counted among the greatest prose writings of all times, and is indeed a pioneering work with his immediacy in revealing the quest of an individual for truth and salvation. By now, the Confessions have been translated into at least 47 modern languages, among them Chinese, Arabic, Maltese, of course, and Lithuanian. Interestingly, as we know now from one of the newly discovered letters, in Augustine's own time, the novelty of the confessions met with a measure of disapproval. As my second point, I wish to emphasize that Augustine was not a scholar in the traditional sense of the word, but an often original speculative writer. He can be seen as the inventor of various new genres and disciplines. In addition to the just mentioned psychologizing quasi-autobiography of the Confessions, we may add his contributions to the philosophy of history, as in the City of God. In other areas, his reformulation of already existing philosophical thought displaced that of earlier writers. For instance, in his theory of signs, his semiotics, which goes back to the Stoics, but most of the Stoic sources have been lost. As we have already seen in his critical attitude towards images, Augustine was not a visual thinker. Only very rarely would he illustrate things in visual detail. Unlike, for instance, the poet Prudentius, his contemporary, who would describe in detail the tortures and wounds of martyr. However, as a speculative thinker, Augustine was concerned to know whether martyrs had their mutilated limbs reconstituted after their resurrection. The richness and flexibility of his thought in this respect are still impressive today. In many significant ways, Augustine established what were to become the principal outlines and foundations of Western theology. An extreme example for the clash between scholarship and creative thinking is Augustine's interpretation of Romans 5:12, and I give you a, if you like, accepted English translation. I quote, "Therefore, as by one man sin entered into this world, and death by sin, in the same way death passed upon all people because all have sinned." End of quote. Following a mistaken philological rationale, Augustine translates this verse from the original Greek, and we know that he didn't like Greek, in a different way. I give you what Augustine says. "In the same way, death passed upon all people by one man in whom all have sinned." End of quote. And so Augustine came to the development of his doctrine of original sin and grace. Now the interesting thing is that despite the fact that the later tradition rejected the exegesis and the translation of Augustine as wrong, it nevertheless accepted the dogmatic, systematic conclusions from it. The third strand to be mentioned here is that, characteristically of a genius and great personality, in Augustine, humor and the sublime come together. As one of my colleagues said, yes, I think one could write a book on Augustine and humor, but it would be a very thin book. Now, one of the things which are very often, if you like, quoted as a punchline, I'm sure you all know that, is his prayer to God in the Confessions, "Give me chastity and continency, but not yet." Yeah? This is on the one hand. There he has something almost funny. And on the other hand, he can be extremely moving in the same book when he describes his ascent to truth while conversing with his mother. I quote, "And we touched upon eternity slightly for one whole heartbeat." And a similar juxtaposition, if you like, of the pragmatic and the sublime, we can see in his attitudes towards the calculability of the end of the world, which was a big issue at his time because people had this kind of apocalyptic expectation. At one point he claims that we do not know and must not dare to know the secrets only known to God, our Maker. Augustine was strictly against any calculation of that sort. Elsewhere, however, he bluntly remarks that to set a date for the end of the world, which proved to be wrong, would be terribly embarrassing. That's the pragmatic person. Now, the fourth strand concerns Augustine's, again, characteristic insistence on the human possibility of search and progress, and on the interrelationship of faith and reason. For Augustine, the Christian God was a reality, not an intellectual or metaphorical concept. This led to a strong God-centered structure of his thinking, a kind of theocentrism, which can be awe-inspiring or spine-chilling. He was radical in his thinking through of the Christian message of the death of a God on the cross on behalf of humanity. If a God had to sacrifice himself in his infinite dimension to compensate for human sin, how unfathomable must this sin then be? What does the greatness and depth of such a divine sacrifice and love say about human nature? And for Augustine, not much good, alas. However, Augustine alerted his readers to the fact that his own thought progressed and must not be understood as a systematic and static whole. He admitted repeatedly that he expected future generations to have better insights regarding certain questions than he himself. Reception has not always taken Augustine up on that. But centuries later, one man did so, even if with conspicuously little success. Galileo Galilei, when he had to defend himself against the accusations of the Church that his scientific approach contradicted the teachings of the Bible, quoted Augustine from his literal commentary on Genesis, that what sometimes seems to be a contradiction between statements in Genesis and scientific observations can later turn out to be none at all. Now finally, as a thinker, Augustine often wanted to have the cake and eat it. A good example would be his attitude towards education and learning, and we are, of course, all very much concerned about that. As the radical theocentric thinker he was, he could state that learning is not relevant for salvation, that all learning could be found in the Bible, that all learning was only as good as the good actions it led to, and, most importantly, that all learning will vanish once we see true wisdom, Christ himself. However, on the other hand, and in the same work, I'm talking about De Doctrina Christiana, he can say that indeed everyone can learn to interpret the Bible, and by following certain rules, preferably his rules, avoid major errors. Indeed, he insists that the knowledge of Latin, Greek, and Hebrew and all the acceptable secular disciplines as an encyclopedic education can be most fruitful and further the understanding of the Bible's content, which is by definition inexhaustible. Augustine's attitude in this regard, together with Jerome, of course, was of no little significance to those in the medieval monastic tradition who sought to justify the inclusion in their theological studies of a dimension of intellectual rigor and indeed pagan classical learning, and thereby preserved it for the modern era. So there again, Augustine is clearly a hinge factor. Yeah? It could all have gone completely the other way. However, Augustine cannot be called the patron of academe. Indeed, in a way, he could afford a partly critical attitude towards learning, because at his time, the educational system and the acquisition of knowledge were still operative. This had changed radically some 150 years later by the time of Cassiodorus, and he is the true saint of universities. Cassiodorus himself says, around 600, that in his time, things had deteriorated. Augustine had known a world in which educated people were accomplished in secular literature and learning. Cassiodorus lived in days when people no longer knew how to spell Latin. Now, in conclusion, it may be asked what relevance Augustine and related matters may claim to have for present-day society. The answer must be, this depends on the kind of society one wishes to live in. And here we come full circle to the beginning of my lecture and the conference on Augustine in Algeria at the beginning of the 21st century. Values like intellectual freedom and progress, creative thinking and rational communication are necessarily linked with academic pursuits, are, in short, the proper concerns of any educational institution. Society could indeed ignore these concerns, but in doing so would risk the return of what followed Cassiodorus, namely the Dark Ages. Thank you very much.
Campus FM għadu kem waslilkom lecture organizzata mill-Istitut Agostinian bit-titlu Saint Augustine the Algerian is meant as a provocation and not as a description of a past historical reality. Il-kellima ta' din il-lecture kienet Professor Carla Polman.